Good evening and welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is John Simon. Simon is a teacher, performer, and community activist. At one time or another, he's been involved in many organizations, including the Family Reading Partnership, the Hangar Theater, and the Drop-In Children's Center. He's also part of the 60s party band Radio London. Welcome to the show, John.
Thanks, Tish.
It's wonderful to see you. Listen, you have a really interesting background. You were brought up in the Harlem, Washington Heights section of New York. You yourself call it a ghetto. Uh-huh. Tell us what it was like growing up in that.
Well, it was really interesting because my parents had met in Pennsylvania at Penn State, and my mom was a Catholic girl from a small town. My dad was a Jewish kid from Pittsburgh, and they got married against everybody's better judgment, and my dad got a teaching job in New York City, and they moved into this apartment right on Riverside Drive along the Hudson River. My dad left like within the first 2 years after I had another brother born.
Hmm.
And my mom refused to go back to Pennsylvania, where they'd say, "I told you so."
Ah.
And so we lived in this apartment building that was mostly Eastern European Jews who had fled. And by the time I was about 3 or 4 years old, somebody in the building died, and a Cuban family moved in. And the Cuban family moved in, and about 10 families moved out.
Wow.
And then a black family moved in, and the Cubans moved out, as well as a lot of the other white families. And by the time I was 10, we were the only white family left in the building, in, out of 60 apartments.
Hmm.
So it was a radical shift. You know, I just kind of, the sands completely shifted under my feet. And found myself living like the only one in my, you know, in my building. And
how was that? Were you treated badly? Were you able to make friends?
Well, yeah, I was sociable, and my brother and I, you know, could, you know, we made friends. But it was also sort of being a lightning rod for people's frustration or anger. You know, being the local white kid. When Martin Luther King was shot and killed, I was walking through the hall of school, and two black kids were coming down the stairs, and one of them punched me in the face and said, "You killed Martin Luther King."
Oh, my goodness.
And he was my hero, you know, so I had that double layer of, like, you know, awareness of being different and kind of having to figure out how to assimilate. And I was a black kid in high school. I mean, I basically hung out with the other brothers, you know, and
mm-hmm. That's interesting for a white person to have that perspective. How unique!
It was really interesting, and you know, it was the only thing I knew. You know, so people say, "Well, what was that like?" It was my life.
Yeah.
And I learned to adapt, but I think in a lot of ways, I also learned how to be very, like, to read the waters and to know how to kind of slide around trouble.
Mm-hmm.
And
it must be interesting to know what it feels like to be an outsider. Because generally white people don't know that at all.
Yeah.
Especially in this culture.
Right.
Yeah. Interesting.
And here in Ithaca, we actually chose to live on Cleveland Avenue, which was the heart of the black community when we first moved in, you know, like 16 years ago.
Mm-hmm. And you say also that you spent time on the farm in the summers. And what do you mean
right.
by that? Was that a commune or was it really a rural farm?
No, my dad was a college professor. And he had summers off, and my mom would give up custody of the boys for the summers, and we'd live with my dad and his second wife and their two kids, my brother and sister, stepbrother and sister,
mm-hmm.
but we didn't have that distinction. And it was 106 acres way up in the Adirondacks, and we went from, you know, living in this, you know, in Manhattan
exactly
to being out in the middle of nowhere, and you know, just four kids kind of fending for ourselves while the grown-ups did other things.
Wow, what an interesting dichotomy of an upbringing.
Yeah.
It's made you a Renaissance man, I must say.
Oh, yes.
But you also stated that you experienced confusion about your racial and religious identity. Talk to us a little bit about that.
Right. Well, I remember I was always in sort of the smarter class. Back in New York City schools, there was a graded system, and fourth grade had 4-1, 4-2, 4-3, 4-4, and actually the higher the number, the smarter the kids, allegedly.
Hmm.
And then I was in a thing called IGC4, which was Intellectually Gifted Children. And by the time you got to the IGC level, it was about 50-50 white kids and black kids, and there weren't that many white kids in the neighborhood. So, and by the time you got down to the 3-1 or 3-2, there were like kids who were just fresh off the boat from the Dominican Republic and didn't speak English, you know.
And so they put them in the stupid class.
Right.
Great.
Yeah.
Isn't and nothing much has changed, it seems.
Yeah.
Unfortunately.
I haven't been back to the city to kind of see what that was all like. But I remember walking home with other kids from my class, and they would be talking about, you know, well, what's your religion? And they were, and I'd say, I'm Jewish, because they were Jewish, you know, and yeah, I'm Jewish. And within a few years, I remember walking down with kids back home and saying, I'm Catholic, man, you know, because...
What were you really, though? Were you brought up in any religion?
No, that's the other... Here's a little family joke. My brother and I took swimming lessons at the YMCA in, down on 60-something Street, and we had to fill out the form for religion. And my brother had once asked my dad what we were, and he said, well, if I'm Jewish and your mother's Catholic, you boys must be Protestant. So we're, you know, filling out the form, and my brother says to the woman, I don't know what religion I am. She said, well, I'm Protestant. And he said, oh, is your mother Jewish or your father Jewish? Because that was the definition we had of Protestant.
That's
and that's
great.
When we found out that my dad was joking. So yeah, we grew up with no religious
affiliation,
huh? Right?
Oh, that's unique. Well, I suppose not. More and more people have come out of the closet as non-religious.
Right.
And it certainly wasn't something that was very accepted back then.
Well, my mom had been traumatized. She was raised Catholic and went to Catholic school for 1 year. And when the nuns broke a ruler over a kid's hand, she said, I'm not going back there.
Yeah.
And my dad grew up, and even though it was sort of the Jewish ghetto in Pittsburgh, anti-Semitism was so thick that he just, you know, avoided being identified as Jewish and wanted nothing to do with it.
Yeah, I actually know quite a few people who have internalized that kind of anti-Semitism.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Listen, I want to talk later about Radio London, but what was it that made you have a stirring toward getting into music back then?
Oh, man.
Was it as a childhood thing?
Yeah, oh, from the very beginning, music was really important to me and my brother. He's a music teacher out in California in a high school. My stepmother played the guitar, and kind of I'd sit at her knee and watch her hands. And my mom always had music in the house. You know, we listened to the Kingston Trio records.
And the folk music was starting up.
Yeah,
too.
A lot of the folk music thing was going on. And so music was always really important to me. And I went to the High School of Music and Art in New York City.
Oh, yeah, the FAME school.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It was the sister school to Performing Arts, which was the FAME one.
Mm.
And music and art back then, just you were an art major or a music major. And you had to get in by audition or portfolio. And I got in as an art major because that's what I did. And when I got in, everybody was so good. I was really intimidated. So I sort of turned away from art and just started playing the guitar. And the crazy thing is, I became a musician, you know, in this, surrounded by world-class musicians in the high school. I'm one of the few who may be earning his living as a musician. So it's this funny thing that
happened. Yeah, that is interesting. But do you think your perception was that everybody was great? Were they really, or was that just your perception?
Oh, it was my perception.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think it was also that thing of, you know, I'm the only black kid here.
You thought of yourself as the only black kid.
Right. You know, and all these other people know how to do art, you know, and like in a lot of ways, I just saw myself through false lenses,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah. Yeah. Listen, I want to play a little something. This is called Booth School. It's something that
you wrote
and you recorded with some kids. Let's take a listen to it.
Great.
Thank you.
That is such a sweet song, John. Just give us a little background on it.
Thank you. Well, I had been doing some songwriting with kids locally through the Hangar Theater. And in Elmira, I had been working as an artist in residence in a couple of schools. And this school called Booth, named after Arthur W. Booth, was going to be closing. They were sort of consolidating some of the schools, doing a reconfiguration. And they asked me if I would come in and write a song for their closing. And I said I would love to do it with some students. So I said, I need a cross-section of fourth and fifth graders. And I showed up, and they had about 25 kids in a room. And I brought some big sheets of paper and didn't know what we were going to do. And we started just kind of, you know, I started like throwing out some ideas and it wasn't going anywhere. And all of a sudden I started doing this song. And they said, yeah, like that. And so we started doing that. And they threw out ideas and I'd throw them up on the paper. And I'd say, well, wait a minute, we have to have a rhyme here. And we came up with this fabulous tune.
So you guys really
tune.
Wrote the song together.
Yeah.
I was thinking that you had penned it.
Huh? Oh, no, this was very collaborative. Yeah.
Oh, that makes it even more special. It's really very sweet.
It was wonderful. And the whole school learned the song. Every classroom got a copy of that recording that you just heard. And they all practiced. And on the last day, they had a huge assembly. And the whole school sang it at the top of their lungs. And me and the 20 kids who had written it performed it from up front. And people were crying and swaying and dancing. It was great.
Uh-huh. I know you're a very involved parent, and you do. You have several kids. You have four kids?
I have four. We have four between the two of us,
uh-huh.
Yeah.
And was becoming a father what got you involved in wanting to work with youth, or did you always want to do that?
I always knew I had an affinity for working with young people. And I think part of it was growing up as the oldest of the four kids on the farm, and I was sort of the, by default, the camp counselor. Who had to organize activities. But I always loved kids, and you know, my dad's a teacher, and you know, I think I come by it honestly that way. But having children of my own really made it like a whole other world for me.
Yeah, your commitment is really touching.
I
think it's wonderful. You also worked with youth in Johnson City, New York, drug prevention program.
Right.
How do you go about trying to prevent kids from doing drugs?
Well, that was right out of college, I was hired to run this grant-funded program to be the director of drug and alcohol prevention. And didn't really have a big background in the field.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there were lots of great trainings that were offered by New York State Division of Substance Abuse Services. And I took some classes in college. You know, I'm certified K-8. In the Commonwealth of Massachusetts to be a teacher. But really, our approach was to work on self-esteem and building support networks among the kids. And we had an effect. We had an impact. Just last week, I was doing a thing in Binghamton for the Binghamton School Pre-K final end of year picnic, and this mother came up to me and said, do you remember me? And I looked at her face and she looked vaguely familiar, and 20 some odd years ago she was an 11th grader at Johnson City High School.
No kidding.
And she said, you changed my life, you know, and I didn't even know it, you know, but just kind of making contact and connections with kids and helping them to connect with each other.
So mentoring in some ways.
Yeah, in some ways. Uh-huh. And setting it up so that they could support each other and connect without having to have the social lubricant, you know, of alcohol or, you know, other drugs.
Yeah, I would think self-esteem would be a key to a lot of problems that kids face in this culture. Yeah.
Yeah.
But since 1992, you also did training and consultation for Cornell's peer counseling program?
Yeah, right.
Well, what is that?
They have a great program called EARS, and it's an acronym, Empathy and Awareness Response. I know the first part of the acronym.
But maybe the second part isn't that important.
Yeah, but it's peer counselors, and they train them to be there as a support system for counseling services. And It's a really nice peer education model. And they bring me in once a semester to just kind of wrap up the semester for the trainers and do a session on self-esteem. And basically at this point, I come in with my guitar and sing songs to them and invite them to join me and kind of just, we have a fun time, and they get to put down their armor and their books and step out of their heads and go into their hearts a little bit.
Mm-hmm. That sounds like an important thing to do, to teach kids self-esteem. We can't get enough of that. It goes with almost every subject we can think of.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, I want to talk a little bit about Radio London.
Great, I'd love to.
The 60s party band, you call yourselves, right?
It's true.
Now, what made you want to form a band that plays mainly 60s music?
Well, it's the music that really spoke to me when I was growing up. And when I was about 12 years old, I realized that I wanted to be a Beatle.
Oh, the fifth Beatle, huh?
Yeah.
Another John.
Right. The other John. I just loved their music, and I loved popular music, too. And it was always the music that I most kind of, it resonated with me most.
Mm-hmm.
And part of it was growing up, you know, I was 12 years old in 1965. So my formative years were spent with this great soundtrack.
Mm.
And my brother and I had this funny little, the Simon Brothers duo.
Oh, you did?
Yeah. And we played, you know, Monkees and Beatles songs and, you know, Temptations, although there are only two of us and not five. And when I moved to Ithaca, I kept looking for like-minded people. And one of the people I bumped into was Jan Nigro, who was a host or a guest on your show a while back. Turns out he also had gone to the High School of Music and Art.
Mm.
He was a few years older than I was. But he and I had the same like musical thing. So did a lot of singing in living rooms, and we decided we should take this thing out into the larger world. And it's amazing watching what happens when we play. And just watching the years melt away from the people who are singing and dancing along. And
do you think it's mainly a nostalgia thing, though, for baby boomers or younger people interested in the music?
Oh, younger people are,
as well?
Yeah, mm-hmm. They love it. And
mm-hmm.
It's hard to say whether it's because it's music that maybe their parents listen to or that it's just better music than what's coming out these days. And I don't know for sure.
You know, I found it curious on your website. You have this little tag that says, return to a simpler time.
Yeah.
Do you really think of the 60s as a simpler time? I mean, I was just sitting there going, my goodness.
Well,
not to me.
Not simpler. In some ways simpler. I have a daughter right now who's a junior in high school. And she's got the internet and she's got a cell phone. And she's like constantly able to connect wherever she is with other people. And the media are so much more
aggressively in people's lives.
Yes,
right? Yeah.
And insidiously have figured out how to do this. And the things that the kids are being exposed to are so much more advanced than stuff that I was kind of stumbling upon when I was her age.
Mm-hmm.
That in a lot of ways, I think it was a simpler time.
Well, I think kids are more alienated by all this technology myself. I meet kids who don't really know how to have conversations, for instance. And I've met many kids who don't really know how to write, which astounds me.
Wow.
So if you mean it that way, but when I think of the 60s, I think of the Vietnam War and the assassinations of the two Kennedys,
right.
Martin Luther King, Kent State, you know. I think of it in political terms, I suppose.
But even along those lines, it was a time when our political leaders inspired confidence and you thought they were doing it because they loved their country.
Mm.
And that's been really hard to grow up in these times that are so cynical and so despairing.
And mean.
Yeah,
mean-spirited. Yeah. So let's turn to a gentler moment and have you... I want to hear the song that you wrote for your daughter.
Oh, good. Yeah, I'd love to.
Yeah.
As I said, I have four kids, and I've written songs for each of them, but this is for the youngest of my four, and her name is Kenzie, and I love this one. It doesn't even have a name yet, and I've been playing it for several years, but it goes like this.
Early in November on the south side of our town, an ordinary miracle occurred. Friends and neighbors gathered round as people spread the word. Another little girl was in the world, and time stood still. Life became an uphill climb of diaper pins and nursery rhymes, and everything we did took twice as long. Sleepless nights and busy days, training wheels and one-act plays, and everything I owned was stained or gone. And time stood still. Sometimes you worry that it always will, but cold Novembers come and go, and none of us can ever know how very quickly it may pass. So when you're with the ones you love, tell them what you're thinking of. Treat each day like it might be your last, because in this life the days just go too fast. That little girl has just turned 4, and soon she's walking out that door. There's so much in the world she wants to see. And then she's 5, and then she's 10, and then she's busy with her friends. And pretty soon you know you'll both be free. And time does fly. You sit and scratch your head and wonder why those cold Novembers come and go, and none of us can ever know how very quickly it may pass. Sit down with the ones you love and tell them what you're dreaming of. Treat each day like it might be your last, because in this life the days just go too fast.
Was lovely.
Thanks, Tess.
Thank you for singing that for us. Sounds like it might be called Time Stood Still, perhaps.
You know, that may be it.
I kept hearing that.
Yeah, that may be it.
I know you're doing a stint with WVBR on
right.
One of their old shows. So tell us what it's like being a DJ. Suddenly.
Oh, man. That's
you've been doing it for about 2 years, yeah?
Three, actually,
three.
Almost. Yeah, this
time
August
does go by quickly.
Time flies. And I'm playing the music that I most love. You know, it's a show called Rockin' Remnants, and the tagline says, best of the 50s, 60s, and 70s. And it's really fun for me to kind of weave together, you know, all these great songs that I know. And we really try and strive to not play the ones you hear over and over again on oldies radio.
Mm-hmm.
And
did you have free creative control?
Complete
That's
creative control.
Amazing.
Yeah.
So you can play things like A Day in the Life and some of those longer Beatles songs?
Absolutely.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. I mean, we do try and stick with charting records, but, you know, based on the Hot 100 charts. But there were a whole lot of tunes, like down at number 93, that didn't get heard much that were great.
Yeah.
And we fold in album tracks and all kinds of stuff.
Are you able to do you play any of Radio London stuff?
No, it's really playing the original tunes by the original artist.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Oh, God, how fun that must be.
Childhood dream come true.
I know you're a committed parent, like I said before. What advice would you give other men, especially, about the importance of being involved with their children?
Wow. Well, the first thing I want to say is that when there was just one kid, I felt like I knew it all, and I knew just how to do it. And by the fourth one, I realized that it's such a crapshoot, and each kid is completely different, and each kid is born to a different set of parents, because I'm a whole different guy than I was when, you know, when Jake was born or Rosie was born. I married into Emma. Emma was almost four when her mom and I got together. But spending time with your kids is really key, you know, and listening and letting them lead the play and lead the activity seems to really help. And by the time they're teenagers, it's more challenging. But I'm really committed to trying to stay close and stay in contact even when they're sort of pushing away.
Yeah, I mean, so many fathers don't stay involved with their kids, and it's really a sad situation.
Well, it's hard because little boys aren't really taught to stay close. You know, in fact, we're sort of pushed out and taught to toughen up. So it's like a language that we forget how to speak. So it was really hard when I first was, you know, up close with this little kid and realized that I had to figure out how to
nurture it,
how to do it,
keep it alive.
Yeah. So, you know, I think it's logical that men head for the hills a lot, or just become emotionally unavailable because we don't know how, don't remember how to to be close and loving.
Did you think that you would ever do parenting classes?
Well, now that I know that I know nothing, I don't think it would be fair.
But you've raised four different kids and you've stayed involved, so you must know something.
Yeah.
No, and you have great kids.
Thank you. Yeah, you know some of them.
Yes, I do.
My father and I did a fathers and sons thing for a while at the Omega Institute, at a couple of other places. And that was really interesting, like working with adult fathers and adult sons and helping them kind of reconnect and figure out what happened along the way.
And how did you do that?
I brought my guitar and we did a lot of structured listening to each other exercises and tried to keep it really light because men, I mean, they'd show up and you just see the fear on their faces, like, you know, what's going to happen here?
And they're afraid of being vulnerable as well, and opening up.
And I think fathers feel like they were never a good enough father and sons feel like they were never a good enough son. So to really just kind of keep reminding them that the forces of the culture are limiting how well you can do that role. But it's not your fault, and you can always start right now to kind of wade back in.
Yeah. Unfortunately, we actually are running out of time.
Okay, yeah.
Can you give your website real quick?
Sure. It's www.johnsimonmusic.com.
Great. Thank you for joining us, John.
Tish, I've loved it.
Our audio producer is Tim Reppert at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. We are a project of the Women's Interfaith Institute in Seneca Falls. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And log on to our new website at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.